Liberty lovers, and welcome to the Liberty Mike podcast, broadcasting from an undisclosed location in the heart of Dixie. I am Michael. I'm here with Liberty Larry.
How's it going?
We've had kind of a weird schedule over the last couple of weeks. Sorry for that.
Yeah.
And it's going to be weird going forward, too.
Yeah, we were just talking before we went on air about what day we want to do. Obviously, we're doing Wednesday today, but we may make Friday our normal day, right?
Yeah, it's just going to kind of depend on how things work out.
It's softball season, so, you know, softball interferes with everything that I do with Michael.
Yeah. We've been through this before, so we'll figure it out again. And we'll get content out to you, as regularly as possible.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess this is a good enough intro, right?
Yeah. I mean, as of right now, man, look, there's so much going on in the news. Like I was watching the other night. It was like just, and I say so much going on, like so much of it is just absolute propaganda, but like they are shoving it hard. So we got a lot to talk about.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be RT tonight, sort of. Like, literally half of my notes are about things with Russia. So so let's jump into Turkey versus Russia in Syria. This is actually something I know that most people don't really care, but this is something that we should probably be a little bit concerned about. It does make me nervous. So the basics are that Russia supports Assad, who's the leader in Syria right now, that, of course, the U.S. spent years trying to remove but has given up now.
Finally.
Sort of, thankfully. Yeah. Now, the U.S. then, after we mostly pulled out of Syria, where we were protecting the Kurds to some degree from the Turks, we sort of encouraged the Turks to deal with the Kurds on their own. And Turkey is using the air quotes here, threat of Kurdish terrorists, because they're not much of a threat to Turkey, honestly.
Yeah.
The Kurdish terrorists as an excuse for a land grab, as far as I can tell. I could be wrong about that, but that's what it looks like to me. So they've moved into Syria along the border to pacify the Kurds or to ensure their own security by creating a buffer zone. To this point, at least, it looks like they're actually creating a buffer zone, not doing the Israel-type buffer zone where you grab the land, call it a buffer zone, and then start moving your people into it, which makes it not really a buffer zone anymore.
Yeah.
You know? But
becomes occupied at that point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. but at any rate, there is you have clashes between Russian and Turkish forces. Russia supporting Assad, Turkey fighting in Syria, where the Russians have been invited by the Syrian government to help defend the government and, take care of ISIS, actually, which is sort of what we were doing there, too. After we made ISIS, then we were fighting ISIS, and when they got out of hand, anyway, we don't
need
to go through.
One of those deals where it's kind of hard to tell which side we really own. Like, we've kind of been on both at one point or another.
Yeah, we've talked about it before. If you want to go back and listen to some episodes, I would love to cite some for you, but I can't right now.
Yeah.
Pretty much you can do a search for Syria, and you'll get the information, though. So basically what happened was, in our attempts to remove Assad from power, we started supporting Sunni militias, the good militias in Syria, and which includes ISIS, or what became ISIS, and it was the remnants of Al Qaeda in Iraq who had crossed the border. They were the Al Nusra Front. Well, they've changed multiple times, but that's the name that you'll most often hear. And we started supporting them, and then they got out of hand, and then they were more of a problem, and we were fighting on both sides of a civil war in Syria, and we were using the Kurds to fight against ISIS, and then we were fighting against the Syrians and the Russians in Syria, even though they were also fighting against ISIS. Anyway, it was a whole big mess. So thankfully, we've gotten out of there.
War should not be that complicated, by the way.
No, it really shouldn't. Turkey's kind of playing the same game that we played over there. They claim that they're fighting defensively, even though they're fighting on another sovereign's territory.
Right.
They invade, and then they call it a defensive war. Weird. So anyway, there have been clashes between Turkey and Russia. There's currently a ceasefire. We'll hope that it lasts. They are trying to ratchet things down. But here's why it's a concern to us. Turkey is a member of NATO.
Yes.
And there is a mutual defense clause in, of course, the NATO. That's like the whole thing about it.
That's what the idea of NATO is if they call for us, we have to go help. And when I say us, I mean all the NATO nations.
Right. And so what you have to start asking yourself is, with Turkey being a NATO member and the U.S. encouraging NATO countries to aid Turkey in their fight in Syria, what happens? Like, what are the consequences of a hot war between Turkey and Russia? Yeah. And do we get drawn into a war with Russia in defense of our NATO ally, Turkey, as a result?
There's no question, at least in my mind. I mean, I don't really know. But it seems to me, at least, that there's no question that Turkey's going to call for us to do that. I mean, it would make nothing but sense.
Yeah, I think that's one of the unfortunate reasons that they're there.
Yeah.
And willing to fight with Russia, who they can't go toe-to-toe with.
Yeah. Oh, no worry. I mean, absolutely.
But I think that they're under the, hopefully, from my perspective, mistaken impression that they actually will get NATO support, like an actual alliance, go in there militarily and fight against Russia with them if they call.
Well, I mean, what makes you think that they wouldn't?
Because even with other all
than the fact that we would be in a potential world war situation.
Well, a hot war with Russia, you know,
People are going to start picking sides. If we end up in a hot war with Russia, people are going to start picking sides pretty quick, and things are going to escalate in a hurry.
Well, I think the real concern is that... I don't believe that all of these think tank military groups and so forth actually believe that you can have a hot war with Russia that doesn't escalate to a nuclear war.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's...
They go out there and they say it. They, you know, they're planning for a conventional war with Russia all the time. Yeah. But I don't see how they could make any kind of honest assessment about that and believe that it would stop short of nuclear war.
It'd have to stop quick. It would have to be it would have to be one of those deals where a little bit of stuff happens and everybody kind of realizes, oh, we got to end this now because it's going to get too bad. Because the longer it would stretch on, the more likely that one of the countries would use them.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say which one. I mean, because I don't know who it would be. But the more it would go on.
It's a toss-up. I actually think it's more likely that we use them first.
It's entirely possible. I mean, I wouldn't bet against that.
Yeah. Just remember, every time this question comes up, that the U.S. is the only country that has ever dropped a nuclear bomb on an enemy.
It's true. Which is all the more reason to think it could be Russia, too, because they're like, well, you know,
they've done it before. Right.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So, I mean, who knows?
I don't know. I don't think that they'll actually get the NATO support that they expect, though, Turkey.
Yeah.
Partly because they're already not making friends with the rest of their NATO allies in Europe with the whole immigration thing, where they've decided to open the floodgates. They're trying to use that as leverage for better deals with the EU. Now, on the other hand, the reason they're trying to do that, I didn't expect to get into this, but I think this is actually kind of interesting.
We're talking about.
The reason that they did that is because the EU promised help to Turkey in dealing with the immigration crisis. This also, by the way, is partly our fault, the U.S. fault, for, you know, creating chaos in the Middle East. And, you know, the terror war has created millions of refugees.
Yeah.
And they're all trying to get out of the Middle East. And, you know, North Africa isn't the place to go because it's just as much of a mess. So the best chance is to get into Europe, you either go through the Mediterranean or you go through Turkey into Greece. And so the EU made a deal with Turkey to keep the immigrants there in Turkey instead of letting them into the EU. But they promised a bunch of support for it, which they haven't really provided. Yeah. And so now Turkey's gotten fed up with that and said, why are we dealing with this huge immigration crisis that they all want to go to Europe? You told us that if we kept them here, you would help us out, and you haven't. So you know what? We're not keeping them here anymore.
It makes you wonder why the EU doesn't just, like, give them a bunch of money to keep them.
Yeah, well, that was the deal.
Right? Like, well, it seems to me like they would want to, I mean, they just print it out thin air anyway, right?
Yeah.
Hence to where we're going later.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Yes, subtle foreshadowing from Liberty Lair.
Yes.
So anyway, just I would say keep an eye on this conflict. Like I said, they're in a ceasefire. Turkey and Russia have had talks, and they have agreed to a ceasefire, and it's holding essentially so far. And nobody's really jumping the gun, based on the weird militias that are still kind of fighting with each other. But the states involved haven't considered that breaking the ceasefire. So they're maintaining, at least as of this morning.
Yeah. It's been a hectic day out there again, so who knows? I mean, things could be changing as we speak.
Yeah, but it's something to keep an eye on because it could draw us into a wider conflict that we don't want to be involved in. And then sticking with Russia for a couple more points probably, we have the other conflict between Russia and Saudi Arabia, and this one is an economic conflict. This is related to the oil. So if you've noticed a steep decline in your gas prices recently, it's because of this.
Yeah.
And so I haven't gotten to read as much into this as I would like, but basically, Saudi Arabia and the other OPEC countries had agreed to limit production of oil to keep the prices high because there was a drop as a result of the coronavirus scare. And Russia said, no, we don't really want to limit our production. We need to keep producing oil so that we can keep making money, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so Saudi Arabia said, well, we're just going to open the floodgates. And Russia said, fine, we'll open the floodgates too. Now, This is a bad move, actually, for Russia, because Saudi Arabia can sustain production profitably at lower prices than Russia and for longer.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I was talking with my brother today. I was like, there's no way the Russians can come out on top of this deal. The Saudis have way too much. I mean, I guess they just have more leverage here than the Russians do. I mean, their capacity is just way more.
And they can produce it at a lower price anyway.
Yeah.
I think at this point, part of it is Russia doesn't want to be pushed around on this.
Yeah.
I think the reason they decided to open the floodgates is they decided, well, we're going to get priced out of the market soon, so we better make our money while we can.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure what the long-term thinking is. Like I said, I hadn't gotten to read into this as much as I'd like. Well, but that's the basics of the deal. And it's good for consumers here in the U.S.
Oh, absolutely.
On the other hand, it's bad for the U.S. energy industry.
Yeah, well, I was fixing to say the flip side of that is any of these guys that are into fracking right now, like, that's being shut down. Like, I mean, once prices hit where they're at now, like, they're shutting all of that down for sure.
Yeah, my understanding is that you have to have about $50 a barrel, about $50 to $55 a barrel to make fracking profitable.
Yeah.
And it pushes down the other energy industries too. Like all this green energy that we want, like they already can't compete with oil because, with fossil fuels because they're cheaper.
Where the prices we're at, yeah.
Yeah. And they definitely can't compete with it at $30 a barrel or $35 a barrel or wherever it is right now.
Yeah.
Russia can't maintain this for long. They will end up having to drop their production and OPEC will get its way. And the prices will rise again. So, fill up now.
Right. Oh, I did. As soon as I drove past, I didn't even know what was going on. I just saw $1.96 gas and was like, what is going on? Like later on, I got some alerts on my phone about kind of what was happening. But I was like, whoa.
Yeah. Now, the other part of this is that this isn't something to be concerned about. This is a cycle. Yeah. This is something that happens. Yeah. If you'll remember, 5 years ago, maybe roughly.
Right, well, around election time.
Oh, was it?
It always seems to fall right around election time. Every 4 years or so, we have a huge drop in oil prices and gas prices go down.
Okay, that's interesting information. I'm going to have to double check that. Let me make a note.
Yes, make a note.
Because I've been trying to figure out the cycle because, you watch it drop and fall, and like the key is to figure out when you want to buy your oil futures.
Yeah.
Because you know the price is going to go back up.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely going to go back up.
But you also don't want to get with a whole bunch of oil that you can't keep in your garage.
Well, exactly. Yeah, right? You got to take possession.
Yeah. Like, if you can't sell it off, then, yeah, that's how it works.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm not saying this is going to hold to election time, because it may not, but it does seem like we have a serious gas price drop right around election time.
Okay. I'm going to have to check the history on that. That's interesting insight.
Yeah.
Not something to worry about, but it is kind of one of those interesting. This is the result of economic war, actually. Yeah. Well, one of the possible results, I suppose. Now, the consumer's winning on this one, at least for a period of time.
Yeah. Well, because what's scary, though, is it could go the other way. Like, they could, I mean, I guess it could. I would assume, like, if they can fight over on being overproducing, couldn't they do the same thing with shutting? But that takes more of a conceited effort, doesn't it?
Concerted.
Concerted. Yeah. That too.
Yeah. Yes, and that's much harder to maintain. So when there's an overproduction issue and it pushes prices down, that kind of levels itself out, because people are unable to produce at a profit for the price once it gets to a certain level.
Yeah.
Just like fracking here.
Absolutely.
And so at some point, they stop producing so much because they can't make a profit on it. And there's only so much of a loss that you'll take to make a point.
Exactly.
On the other side of it, you get to deal with good old self-interest.
Yeah.
So when they're underproducing and they're really driving the prices up, like when they, you know, when prices were getting into the $100 a barrel.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah. You know,
many years ago, people start cheating. Like, they can work together and say, all right, we're going to limit our production to this amount.
Yeah.
But when it starts reaching a certain level, people are like, man, I could make a whole lot of money if I just drop a bunch of oil onto the market real quick.
Like, right now, yeah.
Yeah. And then once one does it, others do too, because they don't want to be left, you know, holding the bag.
Exactly.
Right? So, it's, you know, it's typical market stuff. It's the same thing that you talk about with monopoly, how like a truly free market, like a real free enterprise system, fixes monopoly on its own.
Yeah.
Because the only way you can maintain a monopoly is if you're actually producing the best product at the best price, and probably a range of products, because there's going to be certain niches that would be filled by other, you know, producers. So there's those old stories about Vanderbilt dropping his prices to drive everybody else out of the market, and dropping his prices to a level where he was losing money, but everybody else was too, and he could maintain longer.
Yeah.
All right. So the consumer wins on that, because eventually he drives everybody else out of the market, and he can crank his prices up then, because he's the only guy left in the market. Yeah. But as soon as he does, other people enter the market.
Somebody else enters every time. Like, yeah.
So it's the same thing here. They can limit production and drive the price up as high as they want, but at some level, people start producing because they see that price. They see those dollar signs.
Oh, absolutely.
And then once one does, others do, because why wouldn't you at that point?
Well, absolutely.
Pact is already broken.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then on the downside, it, you know, at some level, you just can't produce anymore. And you can't continue to lose. And so you stop producing as much. Or you stop, actually, what they do is they don't stop producing. They just stockpile.
They
just
stockpile.
Stop selling.
Yeah.
And
because that was actually the way I framed it to some people after I had kind of heard about what was going on. I was like, well, the Saudis have basically started like unloading their supply, because I'm sure they've got just supplies. And I'm just kind of guessing. I don't actually know. But my guess would be is they've got just loads of the stuff supplied somewhere, and all they really have to do is just start releasing it, and it'll affect the market, you know. So it's not even so much that more is being drilled; it's just more is being released into the market.
Yeah. I mean, they can actually ramp up production to some degree.
Well, I'm
too,
sure they can, but
that's a lot of it. Yeah. And what'll happen is that Russia will reach a point where they can't continue to sell it at a loss, and they'll just start stockpiling until the prices climb again.
Yeah. And then there's your correction. Like, there goes back to normal prices.
Right. Because they can't just release it in a glut either, because it'll drop the price again. They're stuck exactly back where they were.
Yeah.
All right, last Russia thing, probably.
We'll see.
And this is U.S. versus Russia on election meddling.
Ah, yes.
And I'm like, seriously, we're doing this again? And also, just to make a point right from the beginning, like the story that was leaked about the intelligence agencies briefing the briefing Congress on Russia meddling in the election again to support Trump and Bernie.
Yeah.
Greatly exaggerated.
Well, it's just amazing to me that it just happens to be the two outsiders that they're supporting too. Like,
yeah. And they
anybody
said,
that's against the establishment seems mm-hmm. to be a puppet of Russia.
Right. Well, and the way it was leaked, they said that it was, with the attempt to, or with the intent, I guess, of having Trump reelected.
Yeah.
They didn't want Biden because Biden could beat Trump. And the people that, I'm just kind of blown
somebody is
that.
Not in tune with reality if they believe that. Because,
well, there's lots of people that, apparently the entire Democratic establishment believes it. Or you could go with the no agenda theory that they're pushing Biden because they've already given up on this election.
Yeah.
That it's a lost cause. They know it's a lost cause, and they don't want to lose all their donors by putting somebody like Bernie or Warren in, up there.
I do agree with some of that because, mm-hmm. I mean, there's nobody in their right mind, and I'm not going to try to make any predictions about Trump over Biden, but nobody in their right mind is looking at Biden like, yeah, he's the guy.
That's the guy?
That's the guy. Like, nobody believes that. I don't care who you voted for. Even if you voted for him, you're not like, oh, yeah, he's the guy. I mean, you voted for him for reasons, but not those reasons. Yeah. Like, have you heard him do any interviews? Like, I mean, come on.
I saw a funny political cartoon this morning. It was a guy sitting at a meal, and he has a lobster on his plate that's labeled Trump. And he says, I don't want this autocratic, old, rich, white man. I'd rather have that one. And he points to the tank behind him. There's another lobster. It looks exactly the same, except it has Biden on its side, you know?
Yep.
Anyway.
Yeah, and that's what it is. I mean,
and then, you know, but the idea is that they're also pushing Bernie because they are sure that Bernie will lose to Trump.
Yeah.
I think Bernie has a better chance because he has a charisma that drives people out. In other words, he gets people that'll come out and vote for him. People will be excited to come out and vote for Bernie. And people aren't excited to come out and vote for Biden. People are excited to come out and vote for Trump.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, he takes something away from Trump by the fact that he is an outsider, and he can play that outsider Trump card, and he can take that card away from Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, Trump can play out the outsider thing the whole way through against Biden, because Biden's establishment, and everybody knows it.
Yeah.
And Bernie is not. Like, mm-hmm. even though he's been there forever, he still has that street cred of being an outsider.
Yeah.
You know?
But back to the meddling thing, there's been several intelligence officers who have said that, that Pearson, who's the, DNI, person that gave this briefing apparently, overstated the extent of intelligence on Russian interference, and what's available does not suggest preference for President Trump.
Really?
That they're just, you know, trying to sow chaos and, to me, the whole thing is really a purposeful ploy by establishment U.S. government to delegitimize the elections in the U.S.
Yeah,
that's what I think it's really about. Is like, okay, well, you know, we're going to go ahead and create this excuse if we don't get our guy again, and that way we can question it and make sure that the president that we don't want can't get anything done because we're going to keep, you know, pulling up these investigations and so forth like they've already done for the last 4 years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I'll tell you something. I was talking with some people about this last night, and it's just kind of neither here nor there, really. But 4 more years of Trump will be very interesting in a situation where he doesn't have to run again, as far as, like, what he would be willing to do and what, like, just as far as, like, releasing information and stuff like that. I don't know. Yeah. I think it would be interesting because he wouldn't have, at that point, I mean, he's an outsider from politics anyway. I mean, I think he would be a lot more, to use their word, unhinged.
Yeah.
And I think it would be awesome. I mean, I think it would, I mean, I'm rooting for it. Like, I think it would be hilarious.
You may be right. We'll probably find out.
Find out. I hope we do, like I say.
But, you know, again, on the election meddling, this idea that they're still pushing this idea that
Russia
interfered with the election in 2016 and is a big part of why Trump got elected and so on and so forth.
Yeah. I just don't think in the second term that's going to play as well. I just don't think that they're going to be able to hold him back the way they have the first term.
Well, maybe, maybe not. But I did want to contrast what we have been given evidence of.
Yeah.
And I just want to also point out that because Russians did it doesn't mean that the Russian state approved it.
Yeah.
It's not as autocratic as it once was.
Yeah.
If you watch servers almost anywhere, like most of the attacks are from Russia. It's not the Russian state. It's a bunch of, you know, also in their basement, you know, their mom's basement, Russian hackers that are trying to get into stuff. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just people.
It's just what it is, yeah.
But what they actually presented us evidence for in the Mueller report, et cetera, is that the Russians spent roughly $110,000 on Facebook ads in the 2016 election to influence the election. All right. And this supposedly, because it was very well targeted, I guess, this supposedly swung the election. Now, just recently, Mayor Bloomberg spent $600 million and won American Samoa.
It's true. Oh, it's so true. Like, it just goes to show you how ridiculous this deal is. Like, there's no way, man. Like,
yeah.
I mean, are you kidding me?
Yeah. He spent 6,000 times as much in a primary to try and earn his way onto the stage, and he won American Samoa.
And we're just supposed to believe that he just didn't know what he was doing with all of this. Somebody that's able to throw around this amount of money just didn't know how to do it right?
Yeah.
Like, because believe me, I saw Bloomberg everywhere. I'm in Alabama, and I saw Bloomberg everywhere. He's on my Facebook. He's on my TV. Like, everywhere. Like, everywhere he could be on the... Everywhere. I don't know.
Yeah, it... I don't know. I don't know either. There's just no sense in it. You need an excuse for why you lost.
I guess.
And that seems as good a one as any, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, we just got outspent. It amazes me that... So, Hillary outspent Trump by a ton, too, in the election. I mean, but they keep talking about how you can just buy an election, but the evidence is not there.
Yeah.
Like, empirically speaking... You lose when you spend more.
Yeah,
that's not necessarily true, but certainly over the last major elections.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of that has to do with the dynamics have changed. Like, the mainstream media isn't what it used to be, and people don't pay as much attention to mainstream media as they used to. And that has an effect, because that's where a lot of that money is going towards, is mainstream, like, TV ads and stuff like that.
Do you think it's because they're listening to us? Are we influencing the election?
Well, I mean, I think you could actually make an argument. In all seriousness, like, podcast and alternative media does have a way bigger impact on the stuff, I believe, than what your, you know, mainstream media does. I mean, at least as much of one. But the thing is we're not organized. Like, podcasts are what they are, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like we're in some kind of organization where we're like...
This is the free market of media right here, actually.
Exactly.
It's just a bunch of people out there producing what they want to produce. And they either get listeners or they don't.
Yeah, and they, you know, it is what it is. But your mainstream media is all in lockstep, which brings us to kind of what's going on with the coronavirus right now. Like, anybody that's watched any news at all, I mean, you can't escape it. Like, it is everywhere all the time, and they are ratcheting up fear like I have never... Well, I have seen before. The only other time I've seen something like this was after 9/11, at least in my lifetime. I mean, I don't know. People who are older than me may remember other things. But the only other time I've seen the media ratchet something up like this was after 9/11. And I was more swept up in it after 9/11. I mean, I was pissed. I mean, we all were.
Yeah.
This is different, and it's scary, because it's propaganda at its worst. I mean, and people are buying it. Well, I say people I run into don't seem to be buying into it, at least not from what I've seen. I mean, most people I talk to are like, are basically feel the same way I feel about it. Like, it's like the flu 2.0, you know? And yeah, it's something to be concerned about, but not to the level that the media is making it.
Yeah. I mean, you say that they haven't ratcheted up fear like this. I mean, maybe I have a skewed view of it, but I think they did the same thing with Zika. That was just last year, maybe the year before.
They did. It was not like this, though. Yeah. Like, it was...
I don't watch a lot of mainstream media.
It was in no way, shape, or form like this. Now, they talked about it, and they did ratchet up
tiny heads.
Yeah. I mean, they did a lot of that, but it was not to this level. Yeah. I mean, it's... You would think, watching the news, that, like, 50% of the people that get this die. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, that's the way they make it out.
Yeah.
And then you look at the numbers, and it's like, they're like not, I mean, they're just low. I mean, at least comparatively to the flu. And I mean, the survival rate's like 98% or something. I mean, there are people that need to be concerned. I'm not trying to downplay what this is. I'm just saying the media is overplaying it.
Yeah.
And that's, and not just like a little bit, because you expect the media to overplay things. I mean, I expect that, but not to this level. And it just makes you wonder what...
This hurricane's going to kill everyone.
Yeah, it just makes you wonder what's really going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And what worries me is that this is leading towards something, because what scares me is what is the government going to try to pull over on us this time?
Well, and they've already started it. So I'm not sure of all the details of the stimulus package that was just signed.
Trump's supposed to make a big speech tonight.
But my understanding is that it includes a bunch of spending for the overseas contingency operations, which is the terror war stuff. It's like, you know, the slush fund for the terror war, or for the CIA, essentially, overseas.
Yeah.
Well, I guess no, it's the slush fund for the DOD overseas, because the CIA is getting a piece too,
yeah.
You know, several hundred million dollars. Department of State is getting a bunch of money. And then all these states that are declaring states of emergency when they don't even have any cases of coronavirus, they're trying to get their hands in the into the pot too.
The trip I'm fixing to make just got canceled today.
Yeah.
So, well... Yeah, and on top of that, like, so the CDC, I guess it was today or yesterday, came out with that they're advising that all of these sports complexes and stuff hold their sporting events with no fans. Like, so I guess, like, the basketball games and stuff, that's going to be trouble come football season.
Well, the thing that really amazes me is that they postponed the release of the new Bond film.
Oh, they did. I did hear about that.
And they'd already started marketing it,
yeah.
Marketing the release. I mean... And, like, maybe a lot of people don't have a real understanding of how much money this is.
Yeah.
It is a tremendous amount of money for them that they've already poured into marketing on this thing. And they'll have to do it again for the new release date.
Yeah.
And so the difference there is what apparently they believe that what they will lose in ticket sales if they try and release right now will be made up if they postpone it and spend this money twice to market it.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of money for a film. Now, a friend of mine suggested what they should have done, and I actually think this is brilliant, so we're giving away free advice for all the movie execs that are listening, he said, well, what they should have done is release it on time, but they should have released it straight to pay-per-view.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, $40 to watch it on pay-per-view or something. They would probably have made, you know, 10 times as much money if they released it in theaters. All these people that have self-quarantined, they have nothing to do and want to watch the new Bond.
You know, actually, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, that could be, we could actually, now that you mention it, I had never really thought of it that way, but that could be the future of cinema, where you don't even go to the movie theater anymore. They just release it at a high expense early, and then as time goes along, the price drops.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it could be, but there's something about being in the theater with the giant screen and the sound and everything. You can't quite reproduce that at home.
There
yet.
Absolutely.
I mean, you have to spend a tremendous amount of money to come close to reproducing that at home.
There is. You're absolutely right about that. But at the same time, people are becoming more and more reclusive.
That's true.
I mean, they just, it's becoming almost part of our nature is, you know, the whole not going to the grocery store, ordering your groceries and stuff like that.
Well, my romantic life is a perfect example of this.
Well, exactly. But you're not alone. Like, I mean, this is kind of the direction that, and it's actually, now that I mentioned it, it's not something that's talked about a lot, but I do feel like in many ways the country is becoming more and more reclusive. And that's not good either. And this only feeds upon that.
It's never been easier to be a shut-in.
It really hasn't. You're absolutely right.
I can get all my food online, have it delivered to my door. I literally don't have to leave my house. I can actually do almost all my work.
Work from home, yeah. And you're not alone in that. Like, there are a lot of people that are in the same boat you are, as far as work is concerned. So, I mean, I'm just saying.
And when I get laid off here pretty soon,
yeah,
this is the only work I have left.
Right? Look, we're working from home right now.
Yeah.
You're home, but still.
Well, so there is another part of this. I mean, they are working hard to try and stimulate the economy.
Yeah.
Now, actually, we should probably go on. I know that what you'd really like to focus on in the coronavirus stuff is for everyone to beware of your civil liberties that are going to be encroached upon.
That's where I was going with all of this, is that because that's when I talk to people, and I've talked to quite a few actually about just this subject, they all see the same thing I see, but they're not taking the next step. Mm-hmm. And that's the civil liberties, the loss of your freedoms that could come mm-hmm. from this.
Yeah. And look what's happened in Italy.
Yes.
I mean, China, okay, you kind of expect
that. You expect it in China, but when you start talking about Italy and some of these other places, and I mean, there was more stuff that just came out today as far as Italy's concerned. I don't remember specifics, but...
Well, they locked down travel in pretty much the whole country.
The whole country, yeah. I mean, they're shutting
stuff
down.
It was like a quarter of the country yesterday, now it's like the whole country today.
Yeah, and it's scary to me. It's terrifying. Like, this is something that people need to be aware of.
Well, and they've talked about other things. They've talked about using the location data from your cell phone to see where you've been, to see if you've been somewhere where you might have come in contact with somebody. And like, think about that. And then, you know, of course, there's the old story. Well, you know, they don't give personally identifiable information when they. So this is go back to the Snowden stuff and the claptrap that Clapper
good one
gave to Congress about how, well, we only collect metadata, you know, there's no personally identifiable information there. Okay, just think for a moment about how much somebody can figure out about you just by knowing your location at various times of the day.
Yeah.
First thing, obviously, they can figure out where you work and where you live. You don't think that's enough to figure out who you are?
Yeah, right. That alone about,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, various groups that you're involved in, et cetera, et cetera. I mean.
Yeah. Us here right now.
Yeah. Yeah. They're planning the raid.
I'm telling you, man.
So this is a concern. This is a significant concern. And this is actually probably the biggest concern of the coronavirus. And this.
It is. Oh, that it without question to me, it is.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been telling people. It's not the virus I'm afraid of. It's mm-hmm. it's the reaction.
And I already gave you several examples. DOD, CIA, like I've already given you several examples of how they're using this to strengthen the national security state.
Yep.
They're using the funds that they're diverting for the coronavirus to strengthen the national security state. And then I would give really strong odds that in this deal, because there's a bunch of Patriot Act or Freedom Act, stuff that's coming up that's supposed to expire. I can give you really strong odds that some of that stuff will be renewed as part of the package to fight coronavirus.
Yep. Oh, without question.
And things that we don't want.
Yeah.
Things that are definitely infringing on your privacy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is where we really need to be careful. You don't need the government to quarantine.
No.
People self-quarantine.
Yeah, we're pretty good at it. Like I said, like we're heading that way anyway.
Yeah.
Like.
And then the other thing is that they're making this out, they're giving you all these figures. There's going to be 15 million dead or what, you know, all kinds of just insane. And I say that knowing full well what I'm saying, insane projections of the number of dead and so forth. Because what they're doing is they're taking the current rate of infection of spreading, and applying it forward. But that's not how infections work.
Yeah.
Well, they don't work that way. They climb rapidly, they reach a plateau, and then they drop off. And that's already happening in China. And it'll happen everywhere else that the virus is spread. There will be they're kind of a bell curve.
Yeah.
Right? So they climb very rapidly, they level off, they drop. This is how infections spread. This is mathematically true. You can look at epidemiology stuff all over the place. This is what happens.
Yeah.
And it's not something to be concerned about. It will not continue this rate of spread.
Yeah.
It will not.
And it's the same thing as Al Gore with the hockey stick graph.
Right.
Where he's just like,
well, what's no, that was completely made up.
Well, yeah, but I mean, exactly. But you take these projections and just start projecting them out and not take in any other factors, and that's where you end up.
Right.
So.
So, you know, just pay attention. Beware.
Please, like, and talk to this about other people, like, get this word out there, pay attention to this. Like, this is such a big, to me, this is so scary to me. Like, you just don't even know, man. Like,
yeah, but not because you're afraid of catching the virus.
No, not because of the virus, but because of the infringements. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm afraid of. That's what scares me, man.
Okay, well, we've got a few more topics to try and get through. I mean, we can push some of this off, but, as part of the coronavirus thing.
We talked about it before the podcast, and I even hinted at it. And I done forgot.
Yeah, we'll get to modern monetary theory. Don't worry.
I see it on the list. I look at that now.
but before we get there, because this seems like a jumping off point, as part of the coronavirus, the loss of economic, expansion? No, we weren't really expanding anyway, but...
Well, I don't know. The Dow, has taken a beating.
Yeah.
My gold prices are still doing fine. Yeah, I bet they are.
Trump, as part of a economic stimulus package to deal with the coronavirus, and he certainly wants to keep the economy from completely crashing, although he's got the excuse now.
Yeah.
But this is the only way I see him losing the election is a real market crash.
And by the way, I think the media and the media and the Democrats, but I repeat myself, know that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I posited this theory
on
our interview with Mike Meharry.
Absolutely.
You did. But he's now pushing for the suspension or even elimination of payroll taxes.
Yeah, I heard
to
that.
To stimulate the economy.
Yeah.
Now, first off, I am 100% behind this.
Right.
Let's stop those taxes. Now, if he would just quit spending too.
Right. That's the other side of it.
We would be okay. Yeah. So I came across this statistic, though, that I found interesting. And it kind of illustrates the kind of push and pull between the production side and the consumer side economists.
Yeah.
Right. And most real economists are production side, by the way. But moving on from that, they were comparing it to the stimulus package, the one-time stimulus checks that they put out in 2011.
Yeah.
After the crash in 2008. And they said of the $100 billion in one-time stimulus checks mailed to 130 million people in 2008, up to 90% got spent, according to 2011 research on the program's impact. Smaller sums tucked into weekly paychecks in the form of a payroll tax cut were spent at about half the rate, and the rest was saved or applied to debt. And they say they're looking at this as a bad thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Good night, man. That's so insane to me.
Yeah. And like I said, this illustrates the push and pull between the production side and consumption side. There's a significant group of people out there that believes that the more people spend, the better the economy is. And it's like this complete misunderstanding of what capital savings does.
Yeah.
Right. The reason that economies expand is because of capital savings. You take your savings and then you spend it to increase production. Like you save up what you got. And Bob Murphy, Murphy, right?
Absolutely.
The economist, Bob Murphy.
Economist, yeah.
He has this example that he uses. He's got the Robinson Crusoe example.
All right.
And he says, okay, and I'm going to screw this up, so I apologize.
You'll put your twist on it. How about that?
Yeah, exactly. So he says, Robinson Crusoe, alone on the island, he spends his whole day collecting coconuts to eat and drink, right? And he needs 10 coconuts. And so and that's how many, or he can take down 10 coconuts a day.
Yeah.
All right. And he consumes those coconuts. And so, but what he decides that at some point that he can get by on 8 coconuts.
Yeah.
But he continues to produce 10 coconuts.
Yeah.
All right. So he takes down 10 coconuts a day, but he only eats 8 of them. Or he only consumes 8 of them. So he puts 2 aside every day.
Yeah.
And after, you know, 3.5 weeks, we'll say, to make the numbers round. After 25 days, he's got 50 coconuts saved up.
Woohoo! Retirement time.
Yeah, you're right. So what he does is, instead of collecting coconuts for the next 5 days, he fashions himself a pole with a loop.
Yeah. Ah.
And so now he doesn't have to climb the trees and do all that stuff. So he consumes his savings of coconuts during that time so that he can produce a technology to improve his production. Now he can produce 15 coconuts a day.
Yeah.
Right.
Still only consuming 8.
Right. But now he can go back to 10 and still save 5 coconuts a day,
yeah,
so that he can build a ladder. Who knows? You know, I mean, but yeah.
So he can expand his coconut
industry. Yes. Exactly. So, you know, and that's kind of the point, is that capital savings is important. Like, people being in debt is not good in the long run, because yeah, it limits their expansion in the future. And if you want an economy to grow, you don't do it by spending money. You do it by saving money and then investing it in it, in improving your productivity in the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I say that with absolute certainty.
I mean, that's it. That's how it works. Like, I mean, that's, I don't see any other way for it to work.
Yeah. And just think about it. If you just take out one factor or the other, right?
Yeah.
If you say that, the way to improve an economy is to consume, consume, consume.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we just make everybody consumers?
Yeah. Right. Start just printing money and giving it away.
Yeah.
And letting everybody, and yeah.
Because if nobody's producing anything.
Yeah. But that's gonna get really difficult really quick.
It's hard to consume when nothing's being produced.
Exactly.
Now, if you do it the other way, like, you can make the same argument, right? Like, oh, well, if everybody's producing, well, no, not necessarily. That doesn't mean that nobody's consuming, because they have to consume.
They have to consume, yeah.
But if everybody's producing, then, you know, then you got a good barter. Everybody's kind of exchanging services.
Yeah. Well, I mean, then it's balance in the system. Like, you want just this, there needs to be balance here, you know? Mm-hmm. But to force it to even think that people are paying off their debts is a bad thing.
Yeah.
Just the whole thought process behind that is just insanity.
Well, and that leads us, I mean, that's Keynesianism mostly. And I'm going to use that to go into the concern about Bernie, AOC, and the like, and their modern monetary theory.
Yeah.
And this has gained a lot of traction because governments love this idea.
Oh, yeah, they do.
And so basically, the idea in modern monetary theory is, since governments create their own money, they can never be insolvent.
Yeah.
Right? And so debt doesn't matter. If you have a bunch of programs that you want, like, let's take the Green New Deal as an example.
Yeah.
Costs so much money. Yeah. Okay, no problem. We'll just print the money to cover it.
Yeah.
We'll print the money to pay for it, and then that'll be fine. Well, then, I mean, like, even the modern monetary theory people say, well, you do have to be a little concerned about an oversupply of currency causing inflation.
Inflation, yeah, that right? was...
And so they say, oh, but that's no problem, because the government can then tax the people to pull that extra money out of the economy and limit inflation.
Yeah.
So there you go. So what happens here is the government prints money so that they can spend it at full value.
Yeah.
Eventually it trickles down to the rest of us plebes.
Yeah.
And it's not worth as much because inflation is already trying to take hold. But don't worry. The government will then take that money away from you to prevent that inflation from getting out of control.
And guess who's going to pay them their taxes?
Yeah. But this is also assuming, this is my favorite assumption about it, is that the government collects those taxes so that they can pull that money out of the economy to limit inflation.
Yeah.
So they'll what, destroy that money?
Spend it. Because guess what? The debt's already so insurmountable anyway that there's no way they can tax their way into paying it off. I mean, and the stuff I was seeing, because I looked into some of this today, and is that debt just doesn't matter. Like, that was the argument that I kept seeing when I was reading and watching videos and trying to wrap my head around this idea mm-hmm. is that just doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter how big. There's no sense. All of these people that are talking about controlling the debt and all of that, that's not a worry. That all we're worried about is inflation. So the argument I heard was, so when Congress decides they want to spend X amount of money on whatever the project is, they need to consider what that's going to do to the inflation, and never mind the debt. That debt doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So, but it goes back to your last point with, well, if the government's debt doesn't matter, why does my debt matter?
Well, because, this is the other thing. I thought this was funny. Okay, so you keep the value of the currency by creating demand for the currency. And the way you create demand for the currency is by taxing, because you can only pay in that currency. And yeah. therefore, you have to have that currency to pay your taxes. Yeah. And that creates demand for the currency to keep the value up.
It seems like all this really would do is make people want to move more and more towards Bitcoin or gold or
something that actually has value.
Something that actually has some value to it.
Well, that's what I see as the major problem with this idea, is that the whole thing rests on the idea that government, not markets, create money. And we had a podcast about this before. Yeah. There's a difference between money and currency. Currency is a representation of money.
Yeah.
It's essentially like an IOU. It's supposed to represent something that actually has value. The thing with value is the money, not the currency.
Yeah.
So government can create all the currency it wants, but it doesn't create money. The market creates money by the market creates money by having a commodity that is easily tradable and that has value to pretty much everyone. It is just a medium of exchange. Yeah. It's not something it's not something that is anything on its own. It has to be something on its own, actually. Yeah. I said that completely backwards. It has to be something that has value on its own.
Yeah.
That people will want because of what it is,
yeah.
not because of what it represents.
Yeah.
And it just happens to be that it, like, the way markets create a money is by having something that's easy to carry around, easy to exchange, usually easily divisible. Like, there's a whole bunch of things that need to feed into it, but it's something that everybody has some desire for at some level. And it becomes something that stands in for regular barter. Yeah. Like, okay, if we use gold as an example, I have chickens, you have cows, I want to trade you 50 chickens for a cow. You're like, I really don't need chickens because I got chickens at home too. And I say, okay, well, how about this gold? And you say, yeah, I'd like that gold. I don't really have any particular need for the gold, but I know that I can trade it to the guy down the street for access to as well.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because it has value to somebody in the market at such a level that you know you can always exchange it.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's where money comes from. Currency is just a representation of that. If you look at old currency here in the U.S., there were like silver notes and mm-hmm. And gold notes. They were essentially things that you could take to the bank and trade in for a precious metal.
Yeah.
And the reason that people did that, or that banks issued those kind of currencies, yeah. is because it's easier for people to carry around the paper than to carry around the metal.
Yeah.
It's also safer. But you know, gold's heavy.
Yeah, right.
And if you have enough silver to cover something really valuable, it's heavy too.
Well, I remember stories of my grandparents when they owned businesses and stuff, like having trunks full of silver dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Like it would weigh the car down.
Yeah.
Like they would have so many of them, and they would transfer them to and from the bank. Just mm-hmm. they at different times they'd have to transport those things.
Yeah.
And
talk about debasement of currency. I'm not really sure what a silver dollar is worth now. I bet it's about $15.
Yeah, something like that. Can you imagine what that is? Because that's what I always think of when my dad tells me these stories. It's like, man, like, can you imagine like what that'd be worth now if you had that trunk full of silver dollars? Yes.
And so, you know, it rests on some other kind of fallacious ideas as far as I'm concerned, too. Like this idea that increasing government spending increases GDP.
Yeah.
Well, that's true, because that's part of how they measure GDP.
Yeah.
But does that actually, is this actually a measure of a healthy economy?
Yeah.
If the government is taxing you, so that, remember, government doesn't produce anything.
Right.
So everything that they spend, they had to take from you first.
Yeah.
Right. So if the government is spending a tremendous amount of money, trillions and trillions of dollars, we don't know any governments that do that, but you know, if they're spending trillions and trillions of dollars, is that actually improving the economy by trillions and trillions of dollars? Is that actually an example of a healthy economy, of growth in the economy? If the government spends, so the U.S. government spent something like $4.5 trillion in 2019. If they spend $5.5 trillion in 2020, does that mean that the U.S. economy grew by $1 trillion?
Not in the current situation.
All else being equal?
Yeah.
I mean, no, absolutely not. Because what they had to do to get that extra trillion was either print it and
which is what they
inflate
did.
Away,
yeah.
Borrow it, and you know, just pass that cost down to a future generation, or they had to take it from you. They had to tax it.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are the only three options. It's the only way that government makes money. They either print it, inflating the currency and making the value of your savings less.
Yeah.
They borrow it, and that just makes it, you know, it makes your children and grandchildren responsible for that debt. Or they take it from you right away with taxes.
Yeah.
That's it. Those are the only options.
That's what you got. Yeah.
So I think that they're, you know, them saying, well, you know, government spending, you know, it expands the economy. I think that that's fallacious to begin with. Because what it really does is it takes money out of people's savings. It takes money out of investment in the future. Yep. It actually hinders the economy more than it helps it. And like I said before, capital savings is what funds economic growth. Yeah. It is what funds future economic growth. And if you're preventing people from saving, you're preventing people from expanding the economy in the future. The government does not expand the economy. Individual investors do.
Yeah.
So that's that. So if that any of you, I mean, like, you know, I'm trying to think of people that I know that might be on board with the modern monetary theory. Like, Carter, if you got answers to this, please contact me, man. Send me a text, give me a call, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I'd be happy to discuss it.
I think this one would be a fun one to have him on the podcast for. Just saying.
Yeah.
Like, just to discuss this, because
he might not believe this. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. It would I don't know if he would or not, honestly. But when I was doing my research on all of this today, I was telling Mike before the podcast, like, I researched four arguments for the people. I didn't research the against. I researched the people that were arguing in favor of this. And I can't.
Did I answer them all?
Without question. And because I wanted to come on here today and argue for it against you. And there was no way for me to do it. Like, I didn't.
Yeah.
In my own ignorance, I'm not the brightest all the time. Like, maybe I just don't understand it well enough to argue for it. But I don't understand how you can do that.
Yeah. Like, well, I mean, I recognize that I may not be giving it a fair shake. I really tried. Like, I did the same kind of thing. Like, I read up on it, what it's about, and I just don't know that I can be fair about it, because to me it rests on so many just like farcical ideas to begin with.
Every step of it is just on thin ice everywhere you go, and I just feel like it assumes too much. So don't know, and who knows? I mean, it's who knows?
Yeah, it, you know, for the types of arguments with increasing government spending increases GDP, therefore economic expansion. Like I said, this is how these terms are defined. I don't think that's actually an argument.
Yeah.
To me, it's, you know, it's a whole lot of even the things that are arguments that are like legitimate economic equations that they're using, where they plug in extra money for government spending or whatever, and it increases total value or total wealth or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, correlation is not causation. It seems to me that you can make the same argument on the other side. Well, if you increase savings, that also increases the economic. Yeah. I mean, you know, so it doesn't mean necessarily that one causes the other.
Well, when I was doing my looking and stuff today, the thing that I kept coming back to and the thing I kept thinking was, this is how you end up in Venezuela. Like, I mean, seriously, like, that's where I kept coming back to. Like this is a setup to end up like Venezuela, except for the world. Because it's one of those deals, if we go down this road and it fails, the entire globe is connected to us in such a way that it'll bring everybody down.
Yeah. I would say if things actually worked that way, the governments around the world would not be so afraid of things like Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Now, personally, I think that Bitcoin rests on nothing, too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the reason I brought up Bitcoin, but I also brought up the metals and stuff, because I do think that Bitcoin's a little flimsy. I mean, at least there is like a equation around how it's created or whatever, but it doesn't actually do
anything. Scarcity does not create value.
That's what I was fixing to say, is just because it was difficult to create doesn't give it a purpose once it's been created.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's my understanding of Bitcoin. Like, you know, it's hard to get, okay, but it's not, you can't do anything with it. Like, you can't, like, make jewelry out of it.
Or exactly.
You know, I mean, so.
You know, gold doesn't tarnish. Doesn't bond with anything.
Yeah. It's also pretty easy to manipulate.
Yeah, yeah. And it's pure form. It's super soft.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Mike loves some gold, guys. I'm just saying.
I'm a bit of a gold bug, but. So. Well, we had one more thing, but we can definitely push it off. We're over an hour, I think, at this point anyway. So
yeah, I feel like we had a lot to say this week.
Yeah, well, it's because we haven't really done a podcast in like 3 weeks.
Not like this.
And I'm glad we could get you guys some quality audio, hopefully.
Yeah.
This time. We'll see after I stop the recording and actually like listen to the first couple of minutes to make sure everything came through all right. Because it's been a while since I set everything up, too.
Yeah,
But, you know,
pull it up and it's going to be like the car.
Yeah. I hope you guys understand we were on the road last two podcasts. I mean, we're recording in a hotel room, which is not really meant for, high quality sound. And then we were recording in a car, which was even worse. Yeah. I had to choose between, having windshield noise the entire way or making us sound kind of hollow by pulling all the windshield noise out. I decided personally that the windshield noise was way more annoying to me.
Yeah.
So, if you guys would have preferred the windshield noise, tough.
Yeah, no, I heard it too. There's no way I could have put up with that for a whole podcast listening to it. Like I would have got a little quick.
Hopefully we got you some quality content out anyway though. And we'll be back kind of to normal. So we'll be doing Wednesday or Friday, I guess, going forward.
Yeah.
Liberty Larry's got some things going on, so I may have a guest host from time to time. We will see how all this works out. I got to work out some tech stuff to make that happen anyway. So,
and it'd be good to kind of get on the ball with the tech stuff anyway.
Yeah.
Because once we have the ability to Skype, we've got some potential for some amazing guests.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want this to turn into an interview show.
No, I don't either. But it would be nice to periodically have some.
Unless it's you interviewing me.
Well, we do that every week, right?
Yeah, sort of.
Kind of.
All right. Well, we'll be back in a week or so, depending. And in the meantime, follow us on Facebook, Podbean, iTunes, subscribe, like and share, tell your friends. We have really cool cards now.
Yeah.
So if any of you are local and want some cards to hand out, certainly let me or Liberty Larry know. We've got, hopefully we don't have enough.
Right. Well, we can get more.
There's some scarcity. So I'm hoping to create demand just based on the scarcity.
Just based on the scarcity. There you go. I like the way you think.
And, we'll be back in a week or so when we finally get this right. In the meantime, try and stay free.
Train how you fight.
Ciao.
Later.